For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. The Step Up Oklahoma plan goes down in flames after only getting 63 of the 75 votes needed to raise revenue for things like a $5,000 pay raise for teachers. As Step Up Oklahoma officials then sent out a statement saying they were done, and Republicans are getting ready to make major cuts. Ryan, what were your thoughts as this failed?
Yeah, my initial thought was, how much further must we fall before we stop asking the question, what's it going to take for elected officials to do their job? And instead, realize that we're clinging to this political system that's designed to deliver dysfunction. And I also think that we need to get over congratulating the billionaire class and their buddies for coming up with this golden parachute. And it was largely their campaign contributions that fueled the campaigns over the last decade that put us in this fiscal mess we're in. Now, I'm not saying that I'm not glad to see him at the table with solutions. I'm a big believer in rehabilitation, but a little recognition that it was their desire for tort reform, work comp reform, lower taxes, and putting politicians in office that would march to the beat of their drummer that got us here. And that's an important lesson. Moving forward now is the really hard part, because I'm of the opinion that our democratic institutions and constitutional constraints like State Question 640 have made it nearly impossible for us to undertake the heavy work ahead. I don't think that means that we throw in the towel, because it just simply means that barring real reforms to the way our government's working right now, that any budget solution that we see in the near term is most likely going to be a temporary patch, and we're going to find ourselves in the cycle all over again. And that's really the best case scenario right now. And it's bleak, but that's where we're at.
Neva.
Well, I think some perspective is needed when you look at the vote itself. I mean, when you take into account that you had 53 of 72 Republicans, you had 10 of 28 Democrats, House Democrats, I mean, that's a significant number. I mean, yes, we have the threshold problem trying to get to the 76, but when you have 63 of the 101 lawmakers, you know, in the House chamber saying that this is, you know, this is at least a plan to move forward. It's a plan to accomplish some of the major objectives that the people really across Oklahoma continue to say they want in terms of the teacher pay and other components. It was, you know, in some measure, I think there was some degree of success in the equation that's really being overlooked. I mean, I think that you had a lot of people under a lot of pressure, a vote that was held open 6 hours, with every attempt clearly to get those extra 13 votes that just didn't come across. And frankly, when you look at it, the heavy lifting was done on the Republican side in the numbers. I mean, had the Democrats not been willing to kind of acquiesce to this notion from their former leader, Scott Inman, as to come up with these lame ideas that they've continued to try to really lay out there as the reasons why they should be against everything, as opposed to coming along and saying, okay, this is not a deal we particularly like. Everyone's saying we don't love the deal, but at least it moves us forward in a way that they're not going to have now. All they're going to have is let's take the money that we've got, let's make the cuts across the board, you know, as lean as we can, but still they're going to be cuts. That's not a good plan.
But the A-plus plan last November got many more Democratic votes, and almost, I mean, 71 votes. They were 4 votes away, and that was only held open for like 45 minutes.
Well, and so here's an interesting thing. You know, we held this vote open. I say we. The legislature held this vote open for hours. 6 hours. They held it up until midnight, I think.
No, they actually let it close early.
But yeah, 13 votes early. I mean, you had folks from the Step Up plan out there, saying, "Oh, we're one vote away from being in our roll call count." That was ridiculous. No one was ever one vote away from this thing. And for legislative leadership to put this up on the board, knowing that, you know, they had to know that they were at least 10, if not more, votes away from passing this. You put something up on the board whenever you've got the votes to pass it, or if you want it to get it off the table and move on with business. And maybe if you're within 1 or 2 votes, you put it up and you can twist some arms in a back room somewhere. But that wasn't even close. It wasn't even close. I don't think that there was any doubt in Republican leadership's mind that this was going to fail when they put it up on the board. But I'll say that I don't think that it's so much a matter of leadership here as it is a matter of institutions and constitutional systems. We have an electoral system that I think gives people too few voices, too few opportunities, and very little real debate over these issues. But also we have things like State Question 640 that creates this artificial threshold. It's not written in the immutable law laws of the universe or anything like that. We could get rid of that by a ballot measure, and we should do it this November, and the legislature should put it in front of the people.
Meanwhile, Restore Oklahoma says they're ready to get going to do the 7% GPT for teacher raises. Do you think that's going to concern a lot of the people?
Well, I think, you know, they're waiting for it to clear the hurdle, I guess, with the Supreme Court, right. And then launch into getting the 144,000 signatures or whatever it is over 90 days or 120 days. Clearly, I mean, they see this as an opportunity to, you know, to get that in front of the people and make their case. I think the setup now is how many additional state questions, just like you said, Ryan, how many additional state questions will the legislature or the people decide that they want to really push in advance and get on the ballot in November? And I think that remains to be seen.
The interim commissioner of the health department resigns after reports of domestic violence surface against Preston Dorflinger. This could have serious impact on an agency which is still reeling from financial issues and many of its leaders jumping ship. Diva, what are your thoughts on this news?
Well, I mean, I think clearly, I mean, it compounds the problem that the health department is in this downward spiral trying to address all of their issues as an agency, but then having this chaos at the helm and now with the departure of Preston Dorflinger, not only from the interim post at the Department of Health, but also as cabinet secretary, where he's been for 7 years in the Fallon administration. So, you know, I think this is one of those times where one incident, 6 years ago, as was described by in one of the posts about the one bad night 6 years ago has kind of propelled this into reality today. But bottom line is that the board at the Department of Health have a enormous task in front of them, and that is to decide who they can bring in, and hopefully quickly, that will be able to hit the ground running and be able to do the job that needs to be done. They don't have time for a learning curve, but they don't have time to just bring someone in that's just an institutional fixture that just kind of plugs a hole and is not really someone that can look at it kind of with a new perspective and some new eyes to figure out what are the problems internally and start to really correct them.
Ryan.
You know, Preston Dorflinger has had more chances than any politician or any political figure that I can think of in the state of Oklahoma. The number of times that he's made, you know, poor personal decisions and ended up in the newspaper, ended up in trouble with the law, ended up with, you know, these 911 documents that have now come forward and the Frontier's reporting, Dylan Goforth and Breonna Bailey at the Frontier. That's the impact of real journalism right there, is that you put that out there and there are immediate consequences. And those consequences, I think, have been on Preston Dorflinger's coattails for a very long time. And it just finally caught up with him. And you know, I think that the swift action on his part to leave, to not force the governor to force him out, which I think would have happened. I think that Governor Fallon and her statements, you know, she takes this very seriously. If it were one bad night a long time ago, but I think whenever you compound that with the corroborating circumstances of many other instances that he's been involved in, you know, this is troubling, and him going was the right thing. Now, at the health department, we're in a, you know, we're already in the midst of a crisis. You know, it's one of the real saving things. One of the things I think to remember there is that, you know, we've got this chaos and this crisis in so many of our state agencies right now, largely as a lack of funding. One of the only reasons that things keep working, they're not because of political appointees or our politicians. It's because of these career public servants, these career state employees
that are still doing their job.
You know, they show up, they've provided continuity for a very long time. And you know, they're the reason that whenever state functions are still working today, you thank a state employee because they're out there making sure that happens. It's going to be those career bureaucrats that are going to, you know, to the extent that they can, stabilize the ship at the health department. You know, the search for a new leader, what they really need over there is they need leadership and they need direction. But I think a lot of that's going to come from these career folks. What they really need is an advocate at the state capitol. They need someone that can communicate exactly what's happening at that agency to the legislature and to other public policymakers so that they can begin to work on the solutions that they need to, you know, give the health department some support.
I think it's also a time where they need a leader who doesn't want to become a career bureaucrat or politician. They need a leader that will come in spend some time. And this is unlike the corporate world where you have someone come in and do the turnaround. I mean, someone that resets the bar, identifies the problems, starts to correct some of those major miscues that have to be immediately addressed, that have the budget ramifications involved, and then move forward. And so I think this board really is tasked with an opportunity to kind of step outside just the normal way that they look at doing business and take an easy, quick pick and look at someone who really can cast a vision, that has the integrity, has the resume, that people from the public standpoint can look at and say, this is someone that I think probably fits the bill, but also can command the respect, like you say, Ryan, to go to the legislature to begin to develop those immediate relationships to where they can convey the message and carry things forward rather than just continue this downward spiral that we're in right now.
Should it be maybe more of an elected official, maybe, instead of
just
because they've already been chosen by people, then rather than
I think that
To me, if you find a medical doctor or someone that's had a distinguished career, someone who is either recently retired or has the ability to step away, but has strong administrative background, a business background as well, that there are people that fit that combination.
Yeah, that's
rather than this notion that we're going to have, which has been advanced this week even at the Capitol, this idea that we're going to have two people. Both of equal standing, one's going to be the medical, the medical person, one's going to be the administrative person, that you can't have a two-headed monster.
Who's the boss?
I mean, who's the boss? I mean, so I hope they get off that idea real fast, because that's a dumb idea in my mind. It's about figuring out, who's at the helm. And so we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think more than elected officials, Neva's right. We need somebody that's got administrative expertise and subject matter expertise over there. And that's, in all of these state agencies. And, these...
And there are people out there that I think if they would just go beyond and look, or at least kind of, throw the line out there, they might be surprised at some folks that would be willing to do it for true public service, not that they need a job, not that they want to get mired into the, bureaucracy and stay for 20 years, because I'm not sure that's the person that they should be looking for.
State Senator David Holt cruised to an early win, an easy win against his two opponents to take the Oklahoma City mayor's seat to replace Mick Cornett, who is running for governor. Holt talked about the bipartisan support he got to win the election. Ryan, how important is for Holt to show himself as nonpartisan?
I think it's hugely important. I think that was a predominant part of his campaign, that he attracted early support from people on the left and on the right. Here's a state senator in one of the most conservative legislatures in the state and the country, working with the ACLU to carry legislation that was the primary vehicle for civil asset forfeiture reform in the state of Oklahoma. Not that we don't need to continue to reform that system, but I think that's the kind of guy that he is. That he was willing to work with any organization if he thought that it was a good idea. There are certainly some real criticisms of him and throughout this campaign, but I think that he's gonna embrace this position. He's gonna rise up to that that call to be bipartisan, to be innovative. One of the real stories out of this, it was an easy win. There wasn't much of a campaign really at all. I think it was predetermined. That's kind of unfortunate. I'm glad that Senator Holt's going to be the next mayor, but it's unfortunate that there wasn't a more vigorous campaign out there for the voters to have a real conversation about the direction of Oklahoma City. And there wasn't, even after that conversation or lack of conversation, the voter turnout shows that. I mean, we had 25,000, almost 26,000 people vote in this year's mayoral election, compared to 2014, when there was a really vigorous campaign between Ed Shadid and Mayor Mick Cornett, 47,000 people. Yeah. So almost half voter turnout from what we saw in 2014. If there's any good news to that, it's that folks that want to do initiatives in Oklahoma City, to put measures before the people in Oklahoma City, their signature threshold got basically halved last night.
Yeah.
Or on Tuesday night.
Neva.
And I think that's right. I mean, the 8.4% turnout is miserable. I mean, when you look at it, 8.4% of the 310,000 plus Oklahoma City voters came out to the polls. I mean, so that number is nothing, nothing to speak well about. I mean, you had three candidates, one who did no campaigning, the second one that did minimal campaigning with no real money, and then David Holt, who did, to his credit, did from the moment he announced that that he was running for mayor, decided that he was going to launch into a full-scale campaign. Yeah. He got 1,300 endorsements early on from people, as you said, across the spectrum and across the city. And I think even in his speech that night, he made the point. And I think he was trying to embrace Oklahoma City and trying to really kind of go with this one OKC theme and really drive it home. And it's, you know, it's regrettable that, you know, while many may have seen or read or heard something about the campaign, they did not feel inclined to really express their either support of his idea and his vision or just go to the ballot box, period. So again, I think as we talk about so often in these elections, it is, we talk about wanting, you know, folks to be involved in the process, and yet it's pretty clear, even at the local level, where they should be probably most tuned in to what's going on, we saw, you know, really a total lack of participation in this election.
And the power of incumbency, and he's such a young man, if he decides, he could be there for a long time.
Yeah, I think that Senator Holt, now Mayor-elect Holt, is somebody that's going to be on the political landscape in Oklahoma for a very long time, whether it's in this position or others. I think that when you have 8% of the turnout, it's difficult to really stand up and say that you've got a mandate. I mean, I think that he had a mandate in terms of being inevitable, or this perception of inevitability with his campaign. But, that doesn't necessarily equal a mandate. And so now he is the mayor, or at least the mayor-elect, and will be mayor very soon. And so it's going to be incumbent upon him to go out and make his case as to, you know, why he should keep that job and why the people of Oklahoma City should believe in him, because he's only one voice. He's got a council to contend with, and if he's going to move that council in the direction that he sees for Oklahoma City, he's going to need to be able to say that he got more than 70% of 8% of the people supporting him.
State Representative Casey Murdoch is about to go to get the new title of state senator after beating his Democratic opponent of the Northwest Oklahoma seat vacated by Bryce Marlatt when Marlatt was charged with sexual assault against an Uber driver. Neva, a Republican winning in Senate District 27 isn't much of a surprise, but it must be good news considering recent losses to Democrats in special elections.
I think so, and I mean, clearly this is a very Republican dominant area and a huge area. I mean, for both candidates to have to campaign over this over nine counties and in a special election getting 9,000 people out, certainly was no small task. And the fact that the Democrat, you have to really applaud the efforts that that she made to be able to get 32% of the vote. It was a very grassroots-driven campaign, trying to carry a message, trying to build a contrast, and for the folks in the northwest part of the state, it was an opportunity to at least have a real campaign. I mean, I don't think that it was given the level of activity that was being expressed out there. No one could just say that it was a given. So I think that for the Republicans, it's good news, and certainly now it opens up a House seat as he transitions from the House to the Senate. But I think it also was interesting when you think about the fact on Monday he was a no vote in the House, and a lot of people speculated with that, how would that play, and really the wind factor and the energy, the wind energy factor clearly came into play out there in that vote, and worked well for him, and had a good result at the end of the night on Tuesday.
Ryan.
Yeah, the step up vote was interesting, but I think that if it had been maybe a week earlier, that it could have had some sort of an effect on the campaign. The night before, I don't know that it was,
right.
but it was interesting to watch him cast that vote in the midst on the eve of an election. Most legislators aren't seeing themselves held accountable that contemporaneously to their actions in the legislature. Maybe that's an idea.
Well, and theoretically, he could have voted in the House chamber, and then by the time sworn in the Senate, could have wound up voting on the Senate side as well.
Yeah,
so it could have been an interesting mix.
That would be interesting. Man.
I think McCaffrey had that happen once. I think McCaffrey had a vote in the House and became senator.
And then got to vote on the same bill twice?
Yeah.
Wow. How about that? The Democrat getting 30% out there, again, your Republican stronghold in the state. But if you look back to the last time that there was a competitive election in that race or a general election, it was back in 2012, and the Democrat then only received around 15% of the vote. So you saw double the turnout. And I think that what if there's any takeaway here, it's that it reemphasizes that Democrats are very mobilized, very energized, even in these districts where it's a huge long shot for them. And I think that that trend is, you know, favorable to the Democrats walking into the November general election in states that are more toss-up, or in districts that are more toss-up districts, and maybe in some of these statewides. That's a trend that if you can go from 15 to 30% in a special and turn your folks out, that means that your base is excited, frustrated, and wanting to show up at the polls and have their voice heard.
Yeah. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is coming under fire again for spending thousands of dollars in travel. Pruitt has defended the use of first-class flights because of, quote, unpleasant interactions with other travelers. Ryan, should more pressure be placed on Pruitt?
Yeah, you know, if Scott Pruitt happens to be listening this morning on his diamond encrusted coal powered radio in his secret phone booth at the EPA, just, you know, turn, you know, everybody else can turn your radios down, because this is directly to you, Administrator Pruitt. You are the administrator of the EPA. You're not some dude who just won an all expenses paid trip on Wheel of Fortune. You need to do your job, and you need to do it in a way that respects the power and authority that you've got. You if you need to, you can command military escorts that cost $30,000 just so you make your trip to the Vatican for a tour. I've been to the Vatican too. It didn't cost me $35,000 to get there. I took my Rick Steves travel book, and it was, I got lost at one point, but it was fantastic. But it didn't cost $30,000, and it sure wasn't on the backs of taxpayers. The audacity of all of this, and the lack of willing to own up to this, I think, is really this lesson that politicians are learning in the age of President Trump. It's that, you know, the attacks that used to, you know, sink a politician's career or used to make them pull their hair out at night are the kind of things that if you just brush them off, there's this sense that the attention span of the voters of the American people, and that the fact that they're already in these the tribalism has already put them in these partisan silos, that there's nothing that's really going to move the meter all that much. All it's really going to do is make folks that like you more, and people that don't like you even less. But at, you know, changing the outcomes of things, there's this sense that it doesn't. And I think that that's where Pruitt is right now. I wish that would change, but I don't see that happening.
Neither.
Well, here's the deal. Administrator Pruitt is the guy that has been the high target from day one in the Trump administration. The folks that didn't like him then don't like him now. They will continue to harp on, you know, this issue and any other issue that can come up that they think they can get some political, you know, grandstanding or fodder. But the bottom line on travel is that you look at Pruitt's two predecessors. I mean, they were, you know, they went all across the world, around the globe, to summits and events and the closing ceremonies in Rio. I mean, you name it. You look at their list of travel through the course of their tenure in that post, and it's very similar to what we see right now with Scott Pruitt. So the notion that these folks are not going to travel, they're not going to be involved on the international stage as well as here, you know, around the country in their role is I think ludicrous. And furthermore, the whole issue of trying to say, you know, on the money side of trying to somehow make it sinister what's being spent. I mean, where's the correlation to any of the other comparable cabinet level posts and what they're doing, you know, as they fulfill their duties and travel, you know, the country and the world as well. So, I mean, I think he's a high target. I think he's an easy target for the folks, as you know, as I've said all along, who, you know, this is an agency that, you know, the folks that are out really don't like the one that's in, and vice versa. So it's always going to be, I think, a place where we're going to get a lot of sensationalism and a lot of focus, but really there's not a lot of new revelations that have come out, even though we've seen some stories again be resurrected this week.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.